I got lucky with the farmers getting their trust and having those intimate, vulnerable moments because I'm just like them. I am a Midwesterner. Like I'm not an East Coast or a West Coast plant. You know, I'm from here, and this just seems to be like the niche and bedrock of my work.
Welcome to Seriously Authentic, the most authentic place on the internet. I'm your host, Larissa Victoria. Authenticity is a surefire way to manifest everything you want in life. Authenticity is a superpower, but it's not for the faint of heart. It means having boundaries, knowing your values, and taking responsibility for how you move throughout the world, aka the hard stuff. Statistically, people's biggest regret on their deathbed is they weren't more authentic in life. I'm on a mission to change that one guest at a time. I speak to world-class experts to discuss how to live a truly authentic life so you can achieve that for yourself. Hello. Welcome to Seriously Authentic. I chat with Sam Mirporian, award-winning Iranian filmmaker and director of Greener Pastures. Greener Pastures is a documentary that follows the day-to-day life of four farmers across the U.S. over the span of 5 years. The documentary is a really intimate look at the themes of mental health, suicide, food production, and climate change that farmers face. Sam breaks down exactly what it was like working on a project for over 5 years, from starting out in his early 20s with no money, no support, no funding, driving hundreds of miles across different states to make it work, even shooting sorority videos on the weekends to make ends meet, from getting funding and getting the support of Emmy award-winning production team behind him, having it bought by PBS, which it is now airing on. This episode is such an insight into the investment of grit and blood and sweat and tears that it takes to make something that you really care about. All right, here's the episode.
Give me a snapshot of your childhood and any formative moments that have shaped you for the listeners.
Is it related to film, or can it just be anything?
It can be anything. I think it's just about like what's shaped you as a person. Like, it doesn't have to be film related, or it could be.
I don't know. I kind of feel like I think about these kind of things often, about where and how, you know, the characteristics and like how I behave, how I act, like where did it come from? Obviously, like we're always like products of our environment. So I feel like, you know, I had a relatively abusive upbringing, and my relationship with my dad still is a little ambivalent. And, you know, I'm Iranian. So, you know, having this Middle Eastern upbringing, you know, there's a lot of pressure to be successful. There's a lot of pressure to be academic, be in the scholastic space, be a doctor, whatever. You know, I felt all those pressures growing up. Also, there was a slight pressure to, you know, try to be athletic, to be an athlete, because I'm tall and I played sports my entire life as well, like through high school. And I wanted to play collegiately. So there was like a multitude of pressures that I always really felt, I think, as a child. You know, and I think something that really resonated with me subconsciously that didn't really hit the surface was with storytelling and film and technology and media, was that my dad worked at one of the universities here at Indiana University, and he was a tech supervisor. He did technology stuff. So he always, you know, would expose me to technology and things like that, which, you know, getting hands on really helped establish like an affinity for why I feel like I do what I do today. And also, he used to bring a camcorder around, and, you know, all of our events as kids, my sister and I, like growing up. And I think, you know, I remember always wanting to touch it and grab it and mess around with it. And he wouldn't let me, because obviously you're a kid. So I think being exposed to that stuff early on, subconsciously, I never really realized how much of like a profound impact it had on my life. But I would say, you know, I was surrounded by a lot of love. I mean, my dad's family, his parents were very loving, and you know, I wish it was kind of unilateral. I didn't really get to spend as much time with my mom, because my dad really monopolized that time during the holidays. But I was surrounded by a lot of love. I'd say support for film, not so much. But you asked about childhood, so yeah, I would say all of those experiences for sure.
Your background and that kind of pressure, societal and cultural pressure to be successful. Do you appreciate that? Like, do you think that maybe like that might have been hard as a kid?
You know, I think when I think about it now, I feel like it has a direct impact with how I really hustle and grind and work hard to, you know, try to achieve and accomplish and do what I do now. So I think maybe it resonates more with me. Like I have an appreciation for it. I think back then, you know, and this is the case with everything, you know, when you're younger, you don't think, you know, you don't think about these things. You don't appreciate what your parents do, stuff like that. So I think like back then I probably didn't understand it more, or I was apathetic to it. Didn't care. So I think looking back now, a lot of the ways that somewhat of like the abuse has been something I've had to embrace and take on head on as I've entered adulthood through my 20s. And now that, and I just turned 30 a few months ago. So like, you know, that has been something I've had to embrace because that has bubbled up into my adulthood and it all stems back to my childhood. So, you know, it's a catch-22. There have been some really great things, but there also have been things and characteristics and flaws that I've had to embrace and I've had to learn with and really try to like mitigate in my personal and professional relationships. But
I don't actually believe this, and I forget who it is. I think she was like in Shark Tank. She had like basically this quote where she didn't want to invest in people unless they'd had trauma in their background, because it was kind of this like, which I think is very twisted, and I'm not subscribing to that, but I do think it's really interesting how, at least for me personally, like sometimes I think like people are like, oh, how did you get through that? And you're like, well, I didn't have a choice. Like the choice is either to literally give up and drop out of life or to like find purpose and meaning over time, like, and just develop a relationship with it, because it never really goes away.
I think different opportunities stem from different socioeconomic backgrounds too. And I think for me, you know, I was like between lower and middle class. So like I was afforded many opportunities. I was raised in a great household. I could not be more grateful, thankful, blessed for everything that I've had the opportunities to. And I will say that majority of, you know, all the space that I'm in now, that has all happened on my own accord, if you will. So like, I think what I can most attribute and really be grateful for, I guess, with my upbringing and my family is just having that, like, the tenacity and the will to do better than your parents. Cause that's also one of the driving forces that I want to do better than the prior generation in my family. Like, and you know, my dad came to America when he was in his 20s during the revolution in Iran. And, you know, I feel like that those characteristics get passed down, honestly, of like grit, tenacity, and wanting to do better, wanting to work hard. So, you know, it's a balance that I really am trying to improve today, where I'm not working as hard, because I feel like now is a great time to work hard, because, you know, then you can relax when you get older. So, yeah, it's definitely something I haven't thought about up until now when you ask these questions. So they're good. They're very good, thought provoking, cerebral things to talk about.
Yeah, I warned you. I warned Sam offline that these were going to be cerebral. So it's interesting that you said this, because have you heard of epigenetics?
No. What is that? Uh-uh.
Oh, man, I think you'd love it. Okay, so epigenetics is basically like this is like a science-backed thing that our genes like carry trauma. So like basically like trauma is passed on. So the first studies that they ever did were with Holocaust survivors. So this is like a real thing that basically like we're carrying around like this genetic code from like these generations of people we've literally never met. And it's like stored in us. Like you said, like your dad, like he was an immigrant. Like, so some of that, like, even though like you didn't immigrate from Iran, you like are having that tenacity, that grit, like almost like this genetic like code that is actually passed on.
That is interesting. And it makes a lot of sense. And when you think about trauma and like mental health, I know that, you know, there have been a lot of studies where like there's like significant research where, you know, whether you are in this environment or this space, like if you're still raised in a conducive upbringing, like you might be predisposed in your 20s or 30s or 40s to have mental illness, whether it's like schizophrenia or anxiety, depression, whatever. And I know that has become like more profound for me, and particularly with men in their 30s and 40s, that's where it becomes most apparent. But like seeing that with my dad and, you know, his family members, like it makes a lot of sense. So that aspect of like what you just said, I can totally resonate with that. It's very interesting.
I think one thing that really impresses me about you is that you are, you're 30 and you're a guy. And I feel like men just like haven't gotten the attention, like in general, like, and this is completely societal. Like, I don't believe it's like related to like gender and gender is construct in general, but they've kind of been like left behind. And like, I think sometimes in some circles, like talking about mental health kind of feels, I don't know, like maybe you're weak or like you're, I don't know, like you should just like figure it out another way. Like, how did you get comfortable talking about it?
No, it's huge. Like, even in the more recent interviews that I've done over the last year for Greener Pastures, because you kind of like, when you're doing like a film like this and a story like this, like you kind of have to champion and become an advocate for the particular cause. And like, it just happened very serendipitously. Like I Greener Pastures at the epicenter, it was about suicide and it was about mental health, but like every other project, every other story happens to just be this very consistent motif in the Midwest that everybody, you know, there's this line of depression and mental health. And so prior to Greener Pastures and Safe Place this year, I did something called Sunny. And I don't know if we were connected then, but, you know, went into that project never thinking of mental health. That was all about just weightlifting and the single father that had a very like unfortunate series of events that happened throughout his life. But at the genesis of him wanting to turn his life around rather than take, you know, medications to be prescribed to something, he started going to the gym 2-3 times a day. And that's what molded him into his life now. And that's how he combats everything he deals with. So mental health, it just became very intrinsic. And, you know, for me, like obviously we all have bouts of anxiety and depression and stuff, in particular when it's, you know, it's seasonal depression when it gets dark at 6 o'clock. So I just kind of embraced it. And I just honestly just started talking honestly about it and open about it. And really the farmers that I worked with in Greener Pastures were really the most inspirational because they talked about it on camera to me. So it's like, why can't I talk about it? Why shouldn't I talk about it? So honestly, it's almost like a full circle moment of me saluting them and giving my thanks to them for doing this. And I want to just give back or talk about it and show support, and hopefully somebody feels inspired to do the same too.
That's like what's so like fascinating and interesting is that I think the worst things in life are like shame, right? And then shame lives in secrecy. So it's like the things that you're so scared to share or talk about, which of course mental health, like we all have it. And I think it's so interesting, like when you just say out loud, like, hey, I'm struggling with this, or like, hey, this is hard for me, like it's not like the circumstances automatically change, but like you've normalized it and like you just feel like safer, like even by like 5% or 10%, because it's not, I'm broken, no one's gonna understand me, like no one's gonna love me, like et cetera, et cetera. And also like life is hard. Like sometimes life is so easy, but like it's like hard for everyone. Like you're lying if you say it's not on some days. It totally is.
No, totally. Like I think what you just said was perfect, where people don't want to talk about it or don't want to say anything because, yeah, it makes them look vulnerable, it makes them look weak. And it sucks because there's that connotation is attached to it. And like, who knows when that'll ever get stripped away. I think that's been around since like the beginning of time. But I agree with you. Like, I think, you know, therapy is great. And honestly, it's just a wonderful way to have a safe place to talk about things that you're dealing with. And for me, like, I went to therapy for a couple months last year and it was great. You know, if I need to go, I'll go when I need it. But right now it was kind of like circumstantial and obviously like the pressure of projects, but like I've alleviated my plate. I'm in a great place now. So yeah, I mean, finding ways to incorporate in your life balance where, you know, some days you might need it, some days you might not. And yeah, no, I think hopefully, yeah, people talk about it more and don't feel weak about it.
Yeah, right. Because it's like actually the strongest thing to do. I also think one thing that literally everyone forgets, and I think this is kind of an amazing reframe, like take your hero, like, or someone you think is really successful, and then they have a team behind them. Like they just do. Like you don't get to a place of success without like a sounding board, a mentor, a therapist, or like a boss or a family member or like a best friend. Could be all of the things, could be something completely different. So I feel like that's what people like. It's a reframe. It's not like you need help. It's like it is so you're a high functioning human being if you made it here today on your own, but like, why wouldn't you like make your life better? Like literally, because like everyone has like support. Like it's kind of like what we can't, there's only so much you can do alone at some point.
Yeah, no, totally. I think, and it gets to a certain place too, where, you know, I've even, you kind of play both sides too, where you need someone and then your someone needs someone. And that's when you got to come in and, I've been on both sides of the coin, particularly last year with friends and support groups and people. And the best thing I learned actually was from one of the farmers in Greener Pastures was that it's always great just to like listen just to listen and not listen to respond. Like some people honestly just want to like talk. And I think the mentality is when a friend comes to you, you know, you think you have to give them advice or you think you have to say something. But honestly, the best thing you could do is just sit there and listen to me quiet and be like, oh, man, that sucks. I'm sorry. Like, be empathetic. And so that's something that I learned. And it kind of goes back, you know, what you just said, like about having support and stuff. So
that could, like, I feel like everyone should pause here because I think the greatest piece of advice I've ever been given is to listen more and say less and know that, like, I feel like the good part that like helps me not like try to solve someone's problem, which is like what you kind of want to do when you hear, is like they're smart. They know, like they probably know, like they just need like a moment, like, and it's, but it's so hard. Like Sam, I actually think it's one of the hardest things to just listen.
The funniest thing really is the funniest thing and the most consistent thing that I feel like this topic encapsulates is in relationships, with romantic relationships, where I will hear someone be like, man, really want to be with her, but I feel like it's not going to work. I want to break up with her. I mean, I couldn't even tell you how many conversations I've had where in the past I've said, you know, I've said things where I'm like, oh man, you should break up with her, stuff like that. And then I've come to a place where the person's smart. The person knows that they probably should break up with them. They're just going to do it like on their own time, when they want to, when it's right. And you got to let them get to that point. That is something that preaching to the choir is a great point. Because so when you do listen, you're helping them really more than being like a voice and saying, yeah, you should break up with them. Like, let them get to that point. So, yeah, it's funny you said that.
And I think actually like one thing that's really interesting that you're bringing up, because I love like the woo-woo stuff. I love the emotional stuff obviously too, but I have this like really big logic part of myself. And like the cool thing that you get from listening is data.
Yeah. Wait, so data, what do you elaborate on that?
So like if I asked you a question and I just let you talk, and the second you were like, I kind of thought like, okay, here's a natural pause. If I just sat there, you probably keep talking. And I would learn, and I would learn more. Like, so then if I actually like could provide something, it would actually be,
yeah.
Because so yeah. Often like we hear people and we're like, oh, have you done this? Have you tried this? And they're like, yes, I have. It's like, you're like, okay. So it's really interesting. Or like, if you're just like, someone stops talking, you're like, tell me more.
Yeah, no, totally. And you kind of realize, like, I hate to say it this way, but I feel like you're the kind of person that you come off as a great friend, that you'd be a person that someone needs to talk, you would listen, you wouldn't talk. I feel like, you know, with your friends, you can really decipher to like what kinds of people are like which direction are they going to go? Like they're like, I always can go to Larissa because she's always going to listen. But then it's like, I can't go to this person because they're not going to listen at all. They're just going to talk over me. And like, that's something I've learned too, where you kind of learn like personality types with your friends, like who's actually going to listen or who's going to just talk over you or just talk and not even be there. So I think that part's pretty funny too. When you talk about like data and just like not talking and listening. So that made me think about that.
Yeah. I think this is actually something I think about a lot, and I don't think it's a bad or a good thing, but I feel like we have less of it. Like we kind of like expect people to be everything. Like it's super good to have that information too. Like who in your friend group is someone you're like, I want to have fun. Like I want to go on a hike. I want to go on an adventure. And who is like someone where you're like, yeah, I actually like really deeply care what this person thinks. And like, I have something on my mind, or someone who like, who's kind of like more of a work friend or something. And you're like, hey, like I think that it kind of got like, and this is like, what's really, really interesting, I think too, like, especially for men and for women and really for anyone, like no matter what you identify with, I feel like we get like less and less community because it's like the more people I think you have in your life who fulfill like super different buckets, it's like, you are like health, you know, like we live longer, like we're meant to be in community. And it's, I feel like that's why the relationship thing is so interesting too, because in like a cis hetero relationship, usually like the girl's like the therapist, you know, like she's like the one, and the guy's like, yeah, like I say everything to you, but it's also like, no, she's kind of like, no, you should have friends. And like, he's kind of like, you also should, I don't know, like there's also that like other dichotomy of like, oh, you're really emotional. And like, that's a lot for the guy. And like, so to me, I'm also like, a lot of it's like solved by just like who else is in your life. Like, it's not actually about like changing yourself or changing your partner. It's like, no, like who else do you have?
No, yeah, I agree. I was going to say dichotomy was actually the word I was thinking about. Like, how do you find different groups or different friends to do different things and like go to one certain person for one certain thing? And like you said, is that for better or for worse? Because, you know, it does take away from that community aspect, you know, like you're not going to be in cahoots with like a large group. You're just going to have a bunch of little sprinkled support groups for different things.
So, okay. Speaking of that, like, you worked on Greener Pastures for 5 years, which, damn, like that's more than like college.
Depends on how long you were in college for, but yeah.
Yeah, I guess you're like not a medical student. But I feel like how did like you have like such vulnerable moments with them, like going back to that, like, was that ever overwhelming? Like, or did it feel really natural and easy, or like overwhelming for you emotionally? Like, I would just love to hear like what that was like.
You know, what's funny, it feels like it happened such a long time ago that I'm really trying to like trace back my feelings and my thoughts. And I remember so much of being like present in the moment and telling myself when things were tough that like this happened several times actually. And I can like viscerally remember these moments where I was telling myself like, man, this is temporary. This isn't going to be forever. Like, we're going to get through this. Like, I remember being sitting on the farmer's couches or doing this or doing that. I remember vividly those memories really stem from when I stayed with Jeff in Monroe, Wisconsin, when I crashed with him on his couch, or not his couch, in his guest bedroom. His bathroom had carpet. You know, it's like the water pressure was none. Remember the first night I got there, it was, you know, like there was no water. It was cold as hell. Like, I was 24. So, you know, you're just like, you don't care about these things. You're just like hoping it works out. And, you know, I would say in 2018, it was all very low risk, had no money. So it was kind of like, I'm just going to drive to these different towns, see what happens. And then I would say the pressure really started to mount, and you kind of start to get to a place where you're like, oh shit, like this is actually going to happen. When, like, you know, you start getting executive producers, you start getting money. And then I really felt the element of like living on the fringes when I had no money, had no support, didn't know where it was going to go. I was hearing things about this shit sucks. Like, I was getting feedback left and right. Like, it was so much doubt and uncertainty. Like, honestly, like, even up until when the film was done, like, at the end of the day, you just, at least for me, I just kept believing in it. And like, you don't want to let these farmers down. And you just also never think it's ever going to get done either. Going from 24 to 29, like, you know, that's half a decade. Like, I was like, dude, this shit's never going to get finished. So it just is really awesome just to like cross the finish line. And yeah, I mean, there's so many moments that I can think of where, yeah, it was challenging and daunting, and you just push through, though.
Yeah. So, like, one thing when I was, like, thinking about questions for you that I think a lot of people don't, like, I feel like we should talk about this more in general is, I mean, I think it's really easy when you're young to be like, I want to be a director, or I want to be a screenwriter. And you, because it's so glamorous and there's, like, kind of these sexy elements of it where, like, it's, like, this really creative job. Like, it's held in society is kind of, like, this, like, dream. But I just love the moment where you're like, it was 5 years of my life. I started when I was 24. Like, there was no, like, and I also love that you pointed out that, like, a lot of people, like, kind of, like, shat on it and were like, no, like, what are you doing? Like, you're young, like, you should go, like, and I think,
oh, man.
It's just, I suppose what I want to say is, like, I know it's rewarding, like, clearly, obviously, it's very rewarding, but, like, you sacrificed a lot of your time.
Man, I mean, oh, God, like, I have emails still where from a mentor, not so much a mentor now, we kind of have like a spotty relationship now, but, you know, he was watching early cuts and Yeah, I mean, verbatim, I'd see things, I'd read things like, yo, like, what are you doing? You don't know how to tell a story. This shit sucks. Like, this isn't working. Your characters aren't compelling. And so you kind of just have to block out that noise, even though it was coming from someone that was, like, pretty trusted. And, you know, the time part was huge. Like, I was also working on my master's. I was teaching. You know, I wasn't making any money. I was making, like, 12 bucks an hour during my grad assistantship. So I was scheduling, like, 7 to 14 day trips every month. So really the formative period of shooting really happened between 2018 and 2019 up until COVID. So in 2019, I was probably going to each state at least 1 to 2 times a week per month. So I remember even verbatim, like how it went down, or explicitly how it went down. It was like February 2019, I was in Iowa. March, during my spring break, I was in Wisconsin. April, I bounced between Ohio and Minnesota. Same thing. May was Wisconsin. Like, you just have to keep going to different things. And I remember I had like a running calendar, like just plastered on my wall, when I was going to go, where I was going to be. Ended up shooting like probably close to like 180 days or so. So it's definitely like a lot of time. And yeah, I mean, I personally too, like personally, romantically, it's you sacrifice a lot. Like, and I will say I was definitely like in the best shape of my life. I was working out every night. I was definitely prioritizing my mental health and taking care of myself. But yeah, I mean, you can't date, you know, your friends are all gone. You're just texting them, you know? So, and yeah, it was, you just like, you don't even going into the film too. Like I didn't know it was going to be that long either. So I think by the time COVID hit, 2020 hit, that's when things kind of changed, because I thought the film was going to be done in 2020. And then, you know, we submitted to like 18 festivals in 2022, got rejected to all of them, and found out it's like, you know, this is my debut feature. So like, I'm not a household name, and all the people in around me, they were telling me to submit a rough cut. Like, don't worry about color. Don't worry about sound. Don't worry about anything. And so I did that, and we flopped miserably. And then here comes 2023. We're finally done.
So yeah. Okay. And here's the thing that I'm really like, I love this story, because you have such a hero's journey. Like, I love that you're like, I got rejected from all 18. That's amazing. Like, because it's amazing, because failing is like literally what a good leader is, and what success is failing and trying again. Like, it's not succeeding every time. And so, okay. And I want to think about this for my listeners, like, and maybe this was just kind of like something that you did because you were young and like you didn't really think about it. But thinking back now, what allowed you to keep going? Like, when like your mentor is being really rude, like you're like, I mean, you must have like you said, you're like, you probably wanted a romantic relationship. You probably wanted to just focus on school and like, hey, all these other things. Like, what allowed you to keep going? Like, what was it?
Well, 2018, low risk, high reward. Had no money, didn't have anyone in stakes in the game, nothing. Nothing was going on then. Because I don't know do you have like filmmaker, like your audience is like probably filmmakers, creatives?
Yeah, there's filmmakers too. And I think, I feel like I'm really like more interested to like in the granular, if it makes sense, but like more like your mindset.
Yeah.
Like, what was it that allowed you to keep going?
I mean, in simpler terms, like, I just didn't want to quit. Like, I feel like by the end of 2018, I was already like 6 months deep. I was driving my little Honda Accord from Indianapolis to Ohio to Wisconsin to Iowa and Minnesota. So I had already seen all these farmers. I already took all these trips, booked the hotels. I shot quite a bit with, you know, my best friend. He shot all the sample stuff. So we were shooting like a sample to raise money to make a deck and do all that. And then my mentor was like, hey, if you want to do this, I can help you get money. So 2018 was low risk. Nothing happened. I was good. So basically what I told myself is like, all right, if I can't get money for this, I'm not going to do it. So I get a $20,000 development grant. So then once I get that in January 2019, I'm like, oh shit, you know, the $20,000 development grant is designed for you to go keep shooting and make a longer sample so that you get production money to keep going. So to make the whole movie. So it's very like sequential, because then there's like post-production grants for the edit. And for me, like not having any money doing all this, like I'm a one trick pony. Like I shoot, direct, edit, produce, do all that. So I was expecting myself to already edit and do everything. So 2019 comes around, and when we got this grant, it's through the Catapult Film Fund. So they're pretty well known in the space. A lot of people are subscribed to their newsletter. So they usually release like who who got the money for that cohort. So once that went out, we had a couple people hit us up. We had a Doc Society, which is an English-based and New York-based nonprofit, and then that does film production stuff and funding. And then Independent Lens, PBS, hit us up. So Independent Lens just like, hey, we'd love to track the project. Lois Fossen, who is an amazing woman, can say so many nice things about her. She's wonderful. And she tracked the project for all 5 years. So she hit us up January 19. And you know, that's who I ultimately sold the film to in the end, was to her. So she's amazing. And she actually was like born and raised on a farm in Minnesota. So Doc Society wanted us to submit to Good Pitch, which is basically where you just like get an opportunity to be picked. You pitch your film in front of a bunch of funders and financiers. So we pitched, we made the top, we got shortlisted out of the top 10 out of like 200 films. We didn't make it, but they were like, hey, we want to put your name in the hat for the Climate Story Lab, which is in June or July. And I forgot about this. I don't remember this at all. So I'm still shooting with this $20,000 that I have. I get an email the night actually after I have an extreme panic attack because I take Jeff from Greener Pastures. He's selling CBD. Because in 2019, CBD was like a real popular thing. So the night after a panic attack, I'm like ready to go home. I'm like, screw this. Like, I'm tired. Like, I'm ready to relax. I get an email saying, like, I got in to the Climate Story Lab and I'll be in New York next month for a week. And then that is when I pitched, and our film and the Greta film that Hulu bought were the only two projects that got funding there out of 10 projects that pitched. And that is where I linked up with David and Linda Cornfield. They did Chasing Ice, Chasing Coral, The Social Dilemma. They've got 3 films at Sundance this year. They're great. They do a lot of stuff with Netflix, and I owe so much to them and Ali Fujino to where I'm at now. And I have Ali and I talk about that later. She's wonderful. And so they gave me 150. And so once I got that money, it was like game on. I got to make this movie now. So then everyone there, they were saying, oh man, you're only 25 years old. You don't know what you're doing. You need to get a producer. Because everything up until that point, I was doing by myself. Like, I pitched by myself, everything. I made a funny story too, where I was like, yeah, this is actually the kicker of how I got the money. I was like, yeah, I make $12 an hour. I'm a grad student teaching. I'm supplementing my income by shooting weddings on weekends, and I still shoot sorority videos. So half the room was quiet, and the other half the room was laughing. And I was like, I'm just being honest. So there's a party later that night, closing night, and this guy came up to me and was like, yeah, man, great job with that joke. Or great job with that, with what you said. I was like, oh, man, that joke. And I was like, oh, man, I wasn't joking. I was serious. He's like, oh, man, that really pulled some heartstrings. You should get some money out of that. So then I got really close to Exposure Labs, and that's when they provided the production dollars. And then we got through the shoot all 2019, 2020. COVID slowed us down by about 4 months, but we got back at it August of 2020. We shot nonstop from August 2020 to December 2020, shot more in 2021, shot a little bit in 2022, and then we got another grant from Doc Society for 100 to finish post. So we raised like 300 or 400, like 350 to make it, or close to 400 actually, and we broke even, which is great because that never happened in independent doc. To answer your question, just little baby milestones would happen along the way that was an affirmation to keep going, so... Just blessed to have gotten finished.
I think that's so amazing because it does like kind of have like, again, that hero's journey vibe where you started alone and it's sort of like every moment where you were like maybe thinking about, I don't know, giving up, but just like pausing it or like not following through, like something happened. Do you like, okay, I'm just like, I'm thinking of you. I'm thinking a lot of you like in the car alone too, like just driving and like what you were thinking.
60 or 70,000 miles of driving, 2 cars, Honda Accord and a Honda CRV. I actually hit a deer in Wisconsin on a country road. So one deer. Yeah, it was a lot of driving and my beard was really long. Like,
I also think one thing I'm really struck by that I think is important for anyone who's like doing like whatever they care about or is thinking about it is I love how honest you were, because I think there's a tendency, at least I feel, who am I to speak to this? Like when you're in New York or pitching your film, like you don't have a producer, you don't have like maybe these things that sort of legitimize you, you know, like maybe someone else has been doing this for a long time with the backing or the money. And I think it's really easy to feel like you almost have to pretend not to be someone else, but just like this different version of yourself. Like, I feel like people think that they can't be authentic. And I actually feel like sometimes like that's like your most powerful like thing is like to actually just be honest.
Yeah. The one thing that really stuck with us with PBS is they said that the film is just like reeks of integrity, which means a lot to me because we really tried to tell it the most honest and like objective way. And yeah, I mean, I think I got lucky because maybe you think I sound Southern, but maybe I do sound Southern, but people listen to me, they look at me and they just absorb me as I try to be as honest as I can as this Indiana Hoosier that just does what I'm a proud Hoosier. Like, I love doing what I do. And my Iranian culture and identity also shapes and molds the way I do things. I got lucky with the farmers getting their trust and having those intimate, vulnerable moments because I'm just like them. I am a Midwesterner. Like, I'm not an East Coast or a West Coast plant. You know, I'm from here, and this just seems to be like the niche and bedrock of my work. So it's easy. And I'm, you know, outside of this, I'm being professional. But yeah, I mean, we're having fun. I'm pretty silly. I like to have moments of being goofy and stuff. So
I love that. Like, I feel like, okay, tell us more about that. Like, what's your playful, silly side like? What is that?
I mean, you know, you just gotta be, I've been told that, yeah, I'm just, I try to be funny. I try to be goofy, you know, try to be lighthearted. You know, you can't always be serious. You know, life's so short, like more laughs. Like, I, you know, singing, dancing, doing all that fun stuff's great. And I love being funny. And obviously I want to give you a good first impression, of course. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think that like when you meet people and you try to do docs, like, you have to be a human too, you know. Like, I remember sometimes like starting out, you have to really foster a relationship, and you have to pretty much show strangers, get them to trust you. And so like I'm taking what they're going to give, and I give that back. And I talk about myself. I talk about things that I've gone through and stuff. And at the same time, like, I'm also just very, I crack jokes. I'm very silly around them. I'm just myself. And I think that's how they trust me. And then that's how we get to show and talk about these moments that you and I are talking about right now. I think for you, it's so great because, you know, you're easy to talk to, and it's easy to have fun and do this. So I try to emulate, honestly, what you're doing. So it makes it easier.
Yeah. So I'm struck by something that I think probably people don't talk enough about. So I have this theory, like, this is personal. I do not expect everyone to resonate with this. I feel like my mom's death was kind of like the marker of, like, you know, I clearly, like, my parents divorced. I've had other things in life that were hard, you know, breakups, all the things. But that was kind of the moment where I was like, okay, I feel complete grief, complete sorrow, like loss of gravity, like my inner tragedy. And I think obviously, like, it took me a lot of time. Like, it's 6 years now. So like, I have like a lot of bandwidth, but I actually feel like what you said, I actually find it much easier to be happier and playful and silly and not take myself seriously because life is so short. And I think that's like something I love about people that have experienced like any sort of tragedy is I actually feel like sometimes they're the happiest people. And it's not because like they don't understand like grief and everything, but it's sort of like, it's almost like one of the only things that you can control. You're like, and so why wouldn't I be happy? Like, why wouldn't I be silly? And I think it's like you almost like embrace like the childlike part of it. And I feel like this is not something we talk enough about. Like, I actually feel like playfulness and silliness like kind of are so intertwined with like hardship and grief. And they're so important. Like, and you need them because like you can't always talk about dark stuff. Like, sorry, like it's exhausting.
Yeah, no, seriously. Like, yeah, I could not agree with you. Like, I mean, even the nature of the work that, you know, I've been doing these last couple of years, it's like super dark and super bleak. So yeah, I agree. Like, being fun, you know, behind closed doors or when I'm not doing work, it's, yeah, be funny as hell, be goofy. Like, I definitely feel like, you know, just separate the worlds. And yeah, because if you're like that 24/7, I mean, you're going to be sad and light. I mean, yeah, apart from all the scary stuff that happens in life and pain and loss and stuff, I think you're right. Like, you can control how happy you are. Yeah. And I mean, you know, embrace the moments that do need to be serious moments. But, you know, majority of the time, just enjoy life, because you know life is great for the most part. It's awesome.
Okay, here's something I actually love your thoughts on. Okay, so I've been thinking a lot about productivity, and so for example, like I'm working on it too, and I've also unfollowed a lot of things, but I'll like end up in this scroll like where it's just, I feel like social media kind of gives you like almost this like high of like sort of thinking you've done something, like when you're on Instagram or TikTok or like whatever your flavor of it is, but yet you haven't. So like I'm even thinking of you. I'm thinking of you at 24, and I'm like, you know, it would be like almost harder to do what you're doing at 24 now, because like as a 24-year-old, like social, do you feel like it is like tied to productivity or not? I mean, this is just genuinely something I'm curious about and I've been thinking about.
Yeah, it's tough because like comparison is the thief of joy. So I think the hardest part about social media is seeing people my age or around my age and accomplishing such great, wonderful things. And you're like, damn, like I wish I could be doing that. So I think that's the hardest part about it, where it's like, damn, maybe that puts me into high gear to be more productive. I will say when I am on shoots and in cities, in different places, I find myself way more distracted and way like less attuned with social media and honestly just communicating with people in general. Like, if it's outside of what I'm doing. So like if I'm traveling and I'm working on a project, I am like so laser focused that I'm only talking to the people that I'm involved with. Like I'm only going to talk to the characters, the subjects, the people that I need to shoot with the next day. Like I don't find myself very engrossed in social media. Like I only really find myself involved in it when I have to make an announcement, I have to share something, I have to put the word out there. Cause yeah, you do have to, it helps build a buzz. It helps get your name, get your work out. So that respect is great. Otherwise, you know, the content creating culture is challenging. I feel like it's so tough. It's probably stressful because you have the pressure to put out things regularly. You have the pressure to build an audience. You have the pressure to keep that audience. And, you know, even for what you're doing, I feel like it's just so challenging. It's probably very challenging, very stressful. And you have to do your research. Like things are constantly changing all the time. Like what a topic might be popular last week, no one might not care about tomorrow. So staying up to date on current themes. So yeah, I would say for me in my work, I use social media more as a tool to find stories, galvanize around my network. And I try not to rely on it too much because I know that it's a double-edged sword. It could hurt me or it could stress me out. And so yeah, I think there's a trade-off in catch 22 either way. Do you feel those pressures?
Yeah, like what you're talking about with the self-comparison is very much something to your point. Like I switched careers, I became a coach. I'm kind of a baby in the coaching world. So of course, the algorithm and I am myself like feeding me like these massive success stories. To your point, it's like, I think about your 5-year journey. It's like, it's so, like the 5-year journey in your brain just goes out the window. You can't focus. You're like the instant gratification. Why am I not here right now? Which is also the assumption of like, if I have this, I'll be happier when X, Y, Z, which clearly like is a myth. So like one thing that is really interesting that like I've worked on a lot that one of my life coaches helped me on was if you're envious or you're jealous, it means you actually relate to a part of the person. Like you see a part of yourself. It's also like, okay, it's just a ping for you like to realize like what you want more of in life or like inspiration. And then like the other thing that I really try to do is celebrate the people that I'm envious of and jealous of and just be like, it's incredible that they did that, like me next. But here's another theory that I have that is really interesting is that I also think that it's okay to feel those emotions. Like they're so normal and natural. And I also have been thinking a lot less about like treating myself like a child. If I had a kid, what kind of like content would I expose them to? Because if I'm picking really inspirational content, like I actually love social media. Like you said, I get inspired. I love to write. Like I love posting. I love interacting with people. I love being vulnerable. But I think more and more I've like unfollowed people in my primitive brain are like kind of interesting or drama. But I'm like, nope. I know it's not good for me. Instead of trying to like change myself to be able to interact with that and not feel crappy about myself.
No, that's great. No, I could not attest more to what you said. You said two things. You said one of them is that you see yourself in people that you're envious about and you say me next. That goes through my head multiple times a day. That is so funny. And then the other thing is that you empowered those people. And I find myself also, it's like, how the hell do you digest what you're feeling? Like, are you jealous? Are you envious? Are you just proud? Or like, it's a medley of all those things. And then if that's the case, is it a positive feeling or is it a negative feeling?
Oh my God.
Cause it's like, damn, like I want to be doing that. Why can't I be doing that? I feel like I'm good enough to do it, but that's really funny. Yeah. Those are some good thoughts.
Let's say you had unlimited money, unlimited resources. Like, what would you make? Do you want to make a fictional story? Do you want to keep making docs? Like, what would be like the dream?
Depends on where I'm at and how old I am. I feel like I would like to do maybe like a couple more shorts and a couple more features in nonfiction, then eventually get into fiction. And it'd be cool to be able to go back and forth between both. So I would say like perfect world scenario. Yeah, it's like and some of the fiction ideas I have are like pretty large, expansive. And I'm trying to develop. Actually, I'm developing and writing something with a kind of a writing partner that I've got in LA now. He's a really cool dude. And we're looking to do something very tangible, very micro, Midwestern-based story. So it's like cheap to make and cheap, easy to do. I'm like actively and progressively working toward getting in that space. But I would say, trying to think, if I had to do a dream doc, and honestly, I really want to tell a high school basketball story because Indiana is the mecca for basketball. Like I played basketball my entire life. Like I wanted to play in college. Like I played in high school, so really want to do that. That's probably, honestly, that is the most immediate tangible dream is I want to tell a high school basketball story.
Okay. So I have two questions to ask everyone. So what is something inauthentic that you have let go of recently?
Something inauthentic is something that I had that I'm really working on not bringing into 2024 that was very strong in 2023 is over promising and under delivering. I'd say that is probably the most inauthentic thing I've actually battled with my whole life. And I would say the reason why is because my upbringing and my dad and everything, because having those expectations, always kind of feeling like you're falling short, but you kind of feel like you have to like make something up or say you're going to do something or deliver it and you don't get it in time. That's been just like a huge character flaw that I've dealt with where, you know, it's been my Achilles heel with personal, romantic, and work relationships where, you know, I say I'm going to do something and I still do it, but it's not to the caliber or the par it could be. So now I'm actively working on myself to be upfront about my expectations and what I can deliver. So like if somebody needs, like, for example, if I'm working on an edit or on a project or something freelance, like, be honest with them about expectations. Don't tell them that you're going to deliver something Friday night when really you need till Monday morning. So that's been a huge constant where I just feel like I try to set the bar so high for myself and it's a cataclysmic failure. So I think that just being honest about that.
Yeah, I mean, I resonate with that so strongly and I'm sure a lot of other people do because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like that's people pleasing.
100%. that's what my therapist said. People pleasing stems from my upbringing and my relationship with my dad. Cause that's constantly people. Yeah. That has been that.
And it's so, I know that because it's like, that's my thing too. I feel like one thing that helps me not people please is like my coach said this and it devastated me. She's like, people pleasing is lying.
It is. Yeah, it is.
A self-aware intentional lie because you're lying to protect someone else's feelings, but it's actually manipulative because what you're doing is you're lying so someone else thinks differently of you so your life is easier or you get validation.
Man, I wish you told me this like years ago.
I just did a DM you out of the blue. I'm like, yo, I know you didn't ask for this, but no, it changed. But I feel the same way. It changed my life because I'm not a liar. I feel like my value, one of my top four values is truth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm addicted to the truth in every way possible. So I was like, okay, that helps. Like, I don't want to be manipulative and I don't want to lie. Like, but I feel like what helped me stop doing it as much is actually still thinking about other people, which is funny, but I feel like whatever it takes.
Man. That was like the best thing I've heard in such a long time. That was so refreshing. That was like one of the strongest things I've heard even outside of what my therapist would tell me last year. My therapist was just very like, she just would listen. She wouldn't really talk or offer advice. I don't know. It's like talk-based therapy or something like that, or listening-based. I don't know, but I wish she said that. I wish I heard that. That's amazing. That's amazing. It is lying. You're right. No, it's fucking crazy. Damn. No. I mean, like, I was just very good, dude. Man, that was great. People need to hire you. That was amazing.
Wow. Wow. Thanks for the plug. I mean, no, it's... Okay, so the next question is, what is something authentic you've adopted recently?
I'd say being patient with myself, being realistic with myself about what I can do. I'm kind of in a really weird space right now because Greener Pastures was my debut feature. I went one for one. It was so easy. Like, I didn't think about any other ideas. I just went in, I did it, and it got done, and damn, here I am. Since then, you know, I think I've tried developing and working on, like, off top, 5, 6, 7 different features. None of them have gone through. And I'm thinking to myself, like, damn, did I really get that lucky with Greener Pastures? Or, like, do I just need to, like, be more patient? You know, don't trip about it. Don't stress about it. Like, just let it come naturally. So I'm kind of in a place where I'm trying to be realistic with myself going in, because I always had this constant pressure that I need to be working on something. I need to keep my career moving forward. So 2024, you know, I just wanted to tell myself, like, be patient, be realistic. You know, if something happens, great. If it doesn't, don't go crazy about it. Don't lose sleep over it. Don't stress about it. And that's really the first time in my life where I've ever kind of said that, because honestly, since 2017, I mean, it's been nonstop. Like 2017, I did Little Warriors, which was my capstone undergrad. And then I did Destination Park with my mentor. And then right after Destination Park was when Greener Pastures started. So, like, it's been nonstop for 7 straight years. So, with all these projects that I've done. So, for the first time, I'm like, okay, well, I'll embrace this period of a solitude or being more quiet or just not working on something. So, for the first time, I've never really done that. And I mean, I'm still working and trying to find something, but I'm not going to let it consume me as much as it usually does.
One thing that I really feel is so interesting is, I mean, you started at 24 and now you're 30. I mean, like, dang, like, you grew up, like, you're not like you, it's like you, this started at 24 and now you're 30, and 30 is a wild year, because I think you do really start thinking about, like, you have enough life in that you have perspective of yourself, like, in your choices. And, like, you start thinking, like, okay, what do I want my 30s to be? Like, what are, like, these long-term goals? And I think it's almost like you have this come down too.
Yeah. I would say for the first time in my life, I feel like I have earned a moment of tranquility and of stillness, because you do feel like that in your 20s, that you're trying to find your identity and trying to work toward, like, figuring out what it is that you want to do. And now I'm just like, well, I've accomplished everything that I want to do up until this moment, and I'm proud of that. And I don't feel that pressure or those expectations anymore. So it's kind of a weird place, because life feels realer. You're not, I mean, when I was in my 20s, like, and you know this, men are 10 years behind women as far as maturity goes. That's why women usually date older. So, like, I for the first time in my life, actually feel like my age. Yeah, I'm still goofy, funny, silly, quirky, whatever, all that shit. But I feel like I'm mature now, and I know my age. Like, I recognize my age. I don't feel like a kid per se that much anymore. I feel like an actual adult with responsibility. And honestly, that hit hard the most when I got my puppy and my house. Buying a house, buying a dog, like, those were two things brand new to me when I was 28. So those were big moments of, like, damn, like, imposter syndrome's kicking in. Like, I feel like I'm an adult now. So it all just kind of happened quite quickly. So just really blessed. And I just want to be healthy. It's all that matters, really, just be healthy mentally and physically.
I think it's so fun, though, because now you have this snapshot recorded in time of, like, you and this kind of like transitional moment. Like,
yeah, no. I feel now, it's a thought that I've been having in my head, actually, because I have to have this conversation with somebody about a particular project, about taking a lesser role, because I'm at a point in my career now, because from 2017 to 2021, 22, basically, before Greener Pastures came out, before Safe Place came out, Sonny was kind of the tip of the iceberg, because that was the first film that I ever sold, had a deal with. I sold it to NBC, and it, like, premiered on Peacock and stuff. It It did pretty well for like my first like quote unquote non-student short, because Little Warriors was a student film. And then when Greener Pastures and Safe Place came out, that's when it really started to feel real to me that like, hey, I actually belong in this space and I actually can do this. And, you know, to have, you know, films Oscar qualified to talk about that kind of stuff, it's really, really cool and exciting. And I never imagined that for myself. So it's just very affirming. And I hope and feel like I'm doing the right thing. So, yeah.
No, but I think that this is like something like before we end that I really want to hammer home is that I think it's really easy to look at someone from like the outside in and be like, wow, like I'm sure there's so many people who like would dream of doing what you're doing right now. And they're like, oh my God, but I think it's really important to remember that like at every step of the way, like sometimes I have days where my life feels so safe. And I mean safe in the sense where I feel so assured. I'm like, I'm doing the right thing. I'm on the right path. Things are going good. I know where I'm going next. I like so, so clear. And then I have other days where I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Like literally, like I feel completely lost. And I feel like it's important to like know that both of those days can exist and that they're both valid. And even when you have an Oscar qualifying film, you can still maybe not know exactly what's happening.
Man, next. I still feel that all the time, every day. Oh yeah. I mean, you know,
right, when every day
trying to raise money for your next thing or trying to figure out what you want to do next, or like if something gets rejected, I mean, you know how this space works. Like it's for every one win, there are 40 rejections. So like none of those rejections feel any more less or any more profound than the other. It just, you know, you definitely, like I said, I had imposter syndrome and like, you don't feel like you belong, and every day is a different challenge. And, yeah, you just take one day at a time. So it's just, I'm totally with you. I absolutely empathize where you're coming from.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Sam, so much for all your wisdom and your honesty.
Thank you.